has got the, so it's a great pleasure to talk about this. It's my favorite topic, and this is a topic that has been somewhat controversial. And in fact, there's a fair amount of controversy since 1997 when this was announced. There is a lot of debate whether this exists or it doesn't exist and what can be causing. And I think this is a nice example showing you how you may have to think in slightly different ways about the methylene slurry transition. And so hopefully today I'll be able to convince you that we have actually a physical picture emerging now that's pretty simple, but it seems to make sense, at least to me. So I would like first to briefly summarize here. I would like to say something about experiments to indicate what I think is the important features of the experiment that will give us some clues. And then the main physical picture is that I believe, and many of us believe, that the Wigner crystal melting is something very similar to the Mott transition. I didn't mention, I should have mentioned, I have lots of several collaborators, several of them are my students, a postdoc, a couple of postdocs, and now we have more senior collaborators down here, Gabi Kotler and Elio Abrahams.
God, is there some way of organizing this so you're not standing right?
Why don't you use the pointer?
Okay, so what I'd like to tell you is that Mott physics, somehow through the proximity to the Wigner crystallization, seems to play an important role. And so I would like to view the 2D transition as a transition from a Minkowskian Fermi liquid to some kind of Mott-Anderson glass. And I'll specify what I mean by doing this. And I'd like to show some results, the specific results we can obtain if we adopt this point of view, and in particular about the metallic phase to show that correlations play an important role in screening the disorder here. And then I would like to show that some aspects of the Mott physics that people have explored in great deal in pure systems actually survives even if you have substantial randomness, even though you have different, slightly different type of transition, that Mott physics will survive. And so this is, I think, one of the main messages of my talk. And finally, I would like to show how when you have random transition to random insulator, then almost necessarily we have some sort of glassy behavior emerging as we approach this transition. And we have now not only theoretical results, but we also have some experimental data from our laboratory by Dagana Popovic, who happened to be my wife, as it turns out. So let me start from the beginning. Probably most people know what the MOSFET is. It's a device consisting of two layers of insulators, semiconductors, and then in between there is an interface where you can form a 2D electron gas. The reason why this is a very attractive and nice device is because the chemistry of that is very simple. This is basically, you can think of this as basically free electrons moving in a plane. So at least from the quantum chemical point of view, that has been my subject of in other correlated systems, you don't have to worry about very much here. So that's a very nice system. There's another very important reason why this is an attractive place to study transition from a metal to an insulator, and that's because this is essentially a capacitor, so by varying the voltage that you can apply across this capacitor, you can, at will, change the number of carriers, which is very difficult to do in bulk materials and other systems. But here, we can get an incredible amount and quality of data by using such a device. So this has been studied for many, many years. And to many people's surprise who are not in the field say, why hasn't this been discovered in 1952 or maybe 1974? Or because the MOSFET is the basis of modern technology, so probably people study it a great deal. And the reason for this is that, most likely reason, in fact, is that around 1980, there has been a tremendous development in the so-called scaling theories of localization, which are particularly well documented for non-interacting electrons. According to these theories, you cannot have a metal insulator transition in two dimensions, but all states should be localized, and even though some of them can have a very large localization length. But there should not be a sharp transition, but rather some very smooth crossover. And because this has been accepted very much, people didn't, you know, even some of the features that I'll describe have been seen by many, many people throughout history. This has been disregarded as, well, this is some kind of garbage, non-interesting, or forget about it. And so it hasn't been studied carefully. And later, as it turns out, when the superconductor insulator transition can be studied, and actually, Sergei Kravchenko, who was the first one to emphasize this similarity between these curves that you get in MOSFETs and the superconductor insulator transition, then analyzed this data in some specific scaling ways. It turns out that then people realize that there's more there than meets the eye. And then a huge amount of work, experimental and some theoretical, has emerged in the late 90s. Let me just show some. This is an example of early data published in 1997. And as you vary the density from, this is a higher density where the conductivity goes up at low temperature, so it's sort of metallic. Then low density drops rapidly to zero. So this is an insulating behavior. So you go from metal to insulator, and you have a whole bunch of family of curves like this that you can analyze. So this behavior has been seen and studied then in great detail. As I said, the MOSFET is a very attractive device for this kind of study. It has been suggested that it's useful for other systems, but apparently we have trouble with that so far. So now let me point out or run you through what I consider our most important striking features of this data. There's a lot of controversy between people who think that most of this we can understand as some kind of crossover or non-universal mumbo-jumbo that means nothing, and those who think that there is something really specific, striking, and singular happening at this one density. But over the last couple of years, we have obtained a huge number of new data that point out that there is something really happening. Well-defined behavior is changing at one density. And this data indicates that perhaps there really is a transition. So let me run you through the features that I think are more interesting. Here is the same family of curves that I have indicated before. You go here, this is resistivity versus temperature. So you have metallic behavior, and you have insulating behavior as you reduce the electron density below some density where it's basically essentially flat here. But the first thing that you notice in these materials, and it's not so much seen in some other materials like gallium arsenide for reasons that are question of debate at this point, but in silicon MOSFETs, you see a very large drop of resistivity on the metallic side. You can actually get in good samples, in the best samples, or highest mobility samples, a drop by a factor of 10 here in the metallic phase. This is more clearly seen on this. This is more recent data. This is the original data. There is about a factor of 10. One of the curves has a factor of 10 drop. This is a very large drop of resistivity, and some people even have speculated about superconductivity here. This doesn't seem to make much sense, though, at least to me. For the following reason, second crucial feature of the data is this. If you look at the plots and you look at where these curves start to decide to go up or down, so basically you have a behavior, systematic behavior, a family of curves that behave in a systematic way, but this starts at a fairly high temperature. I should tell you that here the Fermi energy is about 8 Kelvin. So if you see something starting to decide whether it wants to be a matter and an insulator, and in fact you can do more careful analysis by scaling these data in some phenomenological way, you can achieve this kind of analysis over a very broad temperature range. So the behavior, or whatever causes it, is something that begins at very high temperatures, basically, essentially, roughly speaking, on the Fermi scale. And this is a very important clue because it indicates that this is a behavior that's very robust and probably not dominated by long distances, but rather short-scale behavior, which corresponds to, in relative terms, to high energy processes here. So this is, I think, a very important clue that has influenced a lot of our thinking about the problem. And then they have done more careful measurements. In particular, there have been Shubnikov, de Haas, and other types of experiments that try to describe how the effective mass of carriers, as well as the so-called G factor, behave as you approach, as you lower the density.
But I have a question. Yes. So for these carrier densities, if you, if you have the size of the Fermi surface, right,
yes,
you can take 1 over KF.
Yes.
Get length scale.
What's KFL?
I want to ask the length scale. It's a two-dimensional electron gas, but it has some width. That length scale is comparable to the width, or larger than the width.
Well, this is actually very well quantized. The splitting, another way to answer this question, splitting between the ground state wave function and the first excited subband is about 300 Kelvin. Okay, so it's in a quantum limit where you're in the perpendicular. So you're in the ground perpendicular state. So there are no transverse excitations. It's totally two-dimensional. And this is, people have studied this to the bitter end, especially these engineering questions, because this is the basis of technology. So this is the reason why we know quite a bit about exactly what the wells look like, et cetera, et cetera. Band structure. This has been modeled by thousands of people. So here is the striking behavior. You can see that here is the effective mass. It seems to increase, and you get up to between 3 and 4, close to this critical density, whereas the G factor seems to remain flat. This indicates that even though you may think that there is something similar to ferromagnetism, as it has been proposed earlier, but the fact that the G factor is almost constant indicates this is nothing like emulsions. It has nothing like ferromagnetism, but it looks more like, I guess what's familiar to everyone here, is emulsion condition, for reasons that are not obvious at this point. Another important clue is that if you apply a parallel magnetic field, which will affect only the spin of the electron, then you can suppress the drop of resistivity. And after some characteristic field, there is basically no field dependence anymore. You assume that the electrons are essentially spin polarized. And so this characteristic field, you can determine that as a function of density. And you will see that this characteristic field drops to essentially to zero, to very low values, again at the same critical density where we have this transition from metallic over to insulating behavior. So you see, this is a very striking set of data that indicates that at this one particular density, which is around 10 to the 11 per centimeter squared, there is a drastic change in behavior of the gas. But what I would like to say is that, you see, naively, if you just got a free Fermi gas, you think that this is a finite density, that the field where you can spin polarize should something that should be on the order of the Fermi energy. The point is that this field is much smaller than the Fermi energy as you approach the transition because it goes to zero. So there is an emergence of essentially an energy scale, which is inversely proportional to this mass, or a Zeeman energy scale that go to zero. So there's a small energy scale that is found experimentally near this range. And the main question is, what's the origin of the small energy scale?
Which experiment do you use to infer the field that you need to polarize the electrons?
This is your applied parallel field, and then you can see where the resistance stops depending on the field. Of course, this is done at a series of temperatures, and you have to try to extrapolate to low temperature.
So you're inferring that that's where the thing is fully polarized. It's not
that's right. There is no more polarization. There is no more field dependence. Later, there are other experiments that have actually directly measured the spin polarization due to the splitting on up and down spin bands for shooting from the Hass.
And it actually
it has. Okay, so here are the experimental puzzles. What's the origin of the small temperature scale, of the small field scale? And in particular, a striking question is, why is the temperature dependence on the metallic phase so huge? Why is there such a large drop of resistivity? So those are some simple questions. On the insulating side, there are other questions that are also puzzling, and in particular, I described a few features that indicate there is something like glassy behavior emerging as you come from the insulating side. So these are some puzzling features that you want to try to understand, and my claim is that if we adopt a certain point of view, which is very close to what you may describe as Mott-Anderson transition, then you can understand at least very roughly all of these features. So here's the physical picture. This picture has been proposed by many people. The list is too long to put down. I only put down people who have actually written it. There are many who have been talking about it for years and years. And the idea is very simple. It's an analogy with helium-3. Spivak wrote some short paper, though Gopolo actually has some specific estimates related to this. But here's the picture. At very low densities, and I forgot to say, and this is a crucial point, is that if you estimate the density, if you see where the transition seems to take place, and then you estimate the RS number, you'll find that it is around 10. In other words, the Coulomb energy is about 10 times larger than the kinetic energy, and so that puts you roughly close to the range where you expect that Wigner crystallization may be of importance. So here's a Wigner crystal. In a Wigner crystal, there are potential wells. Each electron is sitting in a bound state in each well, and they can flip the spin. So a Wigner crystal is just a magnet. It's a magnet. In 2D, it's not a ferromagnet as opposed to 3D. It's probably in the relevant density region as antiferromagnetic correlation may have some kind of spin leakage. But it's a magnet, and you may wonder now, there are spin excitations which have extremely low energy because of very large frustration reasons. However, you may wonder about other excitations that may be able to melt this ignorance. And there are two types of excitations. The first type is stretching it like a harmonica and putting some dislocation lines. These are bosonic excitations. These have been studied by scores of people. What hasn't been studied by many people is if you take an electron and put it somewhere else, and it will naturally go in this interstitial site. This is a fermionic excitation that is gapped out in the insulator. But as you raise the density, then the gap will be reduced and eventually will go away, and this will give you metal to insulator transition. This is a process that's very similar to the type of excitation that destroys the Mott gap. So the idea is that you can actually represent, and I think that you can represent these type of fermionic excitations relatively rigorously at very low densities in terms of some kind of extended Hubbard model. In fact, it's a charge transfer model. And then you can ask a question, if I ignore the bosonic excitations for the time being and focus on this route to melting, which is closing this single particle gap, then I may want to use, in particular, DMFT, which is a very useful tool to understand this type of transition. So you may view the melting lignite crystal as a Mott transition. So this is our main physical picture.
Yeah.
Yes.
The analogy with helium 3 is melting the solid. Making the solid helium 3?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the issue is here that we, here in Hubbard model, we have a lattice. On the fluid side, we don't really have a lattice. The same questions apply to helium 3, and similar answers probably are relevant. So, now let me say a few things about, you know, so I'm talking about the metal insulator transition, just a few words really quickly, because we don't have much time, about my view of what the metal insulator transition should be all about and how you should think about this. It turns out this is a type of quantum critical point where there is a vanishing temperature scale. This temperature scale separating the metal from the quantum critical region and the quantum critical region from an insulator. This is a typical phase diagram for the quantum critical behavior, and it has actually been experimentally determined for these systems to some extent.
So that's only in two dimensions, right?
No, this is general scenario in any dimensions for a quantum critical point and for a metal insulator transition.
So you want the metal insulator transition to be second order?
It is a second order. When you have enough disorder, that's what we are talking about here. General belief to be a second order transition, and in fact, there is huge evidence in many 3D systems that this is a second order phase transition. But this is a Mott transition which will be modified by disorder. The Mott transition by itself will probably be first order,
yes,
as well as lignite crystal melting. But the idea is that these systems are sufficiently dirty that it turns into a second order transition. This is probably a very, very general phenomenon. So you can get evidence that this is so if you try in some phenomenological way to collapse the family of curves and look at this scaling plot. You can do beautiful scaling, and this scaling works remarkably well. There are some problems with this scaling, and there is a long story associated with this. I actually was involved in the early days of this field, but I can't speak about these details now. The point is that in several of these materials or samples, you can do something that looks like, just phenomenological grounds, has beautiful scaling over a very broad range of parameters. So this supports that there is such a picture of the metal insulator transition as a quantum critical point. So if we now talk about quantum critical points, we would like to ask the question, well, what kind of theories do we need? And most of the quantum critical points are associated with spontaneous symmetry breaking, which allows for us then to write down an order parameter theory, Randall Ginsburg theory, and then people with bigger guns come along and solve these problems using RG methods, field theory, conformal field theory, and that. But it's sometimes difficult to use these approaches if you don't really know what symmetry is broken. In a ferromagnet and similar systems, liquid crystals, superconductors, we have a broken symmetry that we know what it is. It's a static order parameter. The problem here is that we don't really know what would be, there is no such obvious symmetry breaking. And so this seems to be a slightly different problem where we don't know what the order parameter is. There are also huge spatial fluctuations, and on top of it, as we go to the insulator, instead of single ground state, there can be many ground states. So all of these things are seems to be confusing, but when I was a graduate student, I read a book that was an article that was written by Phil Anderson who says this, orthodox phase transition theory will be of little help to us for the time being, and thus the great body of literature in the field is simply irrelevant. It is to some extent true that standard methods are not very well suited for this problem. So you would, if you cannot do the simple Landau-Ginsburg approach, well, what are we going to do? And the answer is that dynamical mean field theory not only offers a practical tool, but it offers for us a way to think about what, you know, is the basic physical process. And let me say just a few words about this. The key idea is that this phase transition, even though it's a critical point, it's a dynamical transition in the sense the transport properties and the time dependence changes, but not necessarily static ordering. Okay, and so that's why we need a dynamical theory and not a static theory. But what is the order parameter that you can should think and be thinking about? Okay. And this is great. I just love this thing. So you can ask Fermi over here how to do the calculation, and he says we should use the golden rule. What does the golden rule says is that if we are sitting on a given side and we would like to decide whether we are in a metal or we are in an insulator, then we would like to determine the escape rate from the side. This was the idea presented, in fact, by Anderson in 1958 for the non-tracking problem. And the transition rate from the site is just the matrix element squared times the density of final states describing this environment. And this basically gives you an escape rate here. So this is a very simple idea. And now dynamical mean field theory, you can think of it as basically self-consistently determining the number of available states into which I can escape. A very simple idea. And this theory has been developed. I'm not going to talk about any technical details here. There's a lot of technical work, and has been successfully applied to several correlated systems in absence of disorder. And there's a little bit of work done with disorder. I've done some work with several collaborators, but most of the work has been on mod transitions, heavy fermions, and similar systems. The first question that comes to mind is, well, we are talking about strongly disordered systems, and that the nature of the transition has changed. Can we, in fact, can we hope to capture the crucial aspect, which is the Anderson localization, in this picture? So I'm talking about a picture where we are escaping from the site and asking the question, how many states do we have in the environment? And the answer to that is that several years ago, we realized that this, if you phrase your order parameter theory in this language, then you can actually describe both the mod-like transition, where just a hard gap opens, essentially a band gap, so there are no states whatsoever, or an Anderson transition where the situation is similar but not identical. This second issue is less familiar to many people. Many people think that Anderson insulators have no gaps. Okay. However, they have gaps, and this is the reason why we have an Anderson insulator. And let me tell you exactly how it works. So what I'm saying is that we need the number of states, but not in the whole system, the number of available states in the immediate vicinity of a given site. So it's a local density of states, or average over a few sites. This local density of states, here are snapshots from our simulation on beta lattice, in fact. In a clean limit, it's just a band. Here is the Fermi energy in the middle. And in a very strongly disordered limit, localized limit, where all the states are bound, there are only a few peaks. Why do we have only a few peaks? Because there are only a few bound states overlapping with a given site.
Just for a given sample, right?
That's for a given sample and for a given site. Okay. So if you're sitting somewhere here in one of these gaps, you have no chance of escaping, because there's only few states to which you can jump, and they unfortunately don't sit exactly at your range. So we don't have a hard gap, but we have randomly positioned gap with random sizes. If you average over the entire sample, the gap is lost. But each site has its own gap, so there's a typical gap size that you can think about.
I mean, those little spikes, right, they're dense on that line. They're just exponentially smaller or higher.
That's right. They are. So they come from states which are distant, but they are, the tail is exponentially smaller.
So you don't have, it's not a mathematical notion of exactly what the gap is.
Absolutely. So we can be more precise. This is a very good question. If you take this and imagine what's going to happen if you go to the metallic side, some of these peaks are going to be broadened. So there's a characteristic width of these peaks and proportional to it a background which is finite. So now we have a finite density of states, but the background, the typical density of states here, is very, very small. Okay? So if we define the typical density of states as the most probable value, which turns out is very well represented by the geometric average, okay, then you can show, and this has been known for many years, that this geometric average, or the typical density of states available to you, goes to literally to zero at the Anderson transition. There are various numerical, analytical, and other studies which confirm this notion.
So in other words, you're computing the expectation of the logarithm of the density of states over all omegas and then taking exponentiating.
Well, at one omega. At one omega, I'm just averaging this
over
samples. Over samples, yes. Over the soil. Averaging over those edges.
Okay.
At one energy. The energy is conserved. Okay, this is a non-interacting case. So you can use this idea and actually use this as an order parameter. We have a paper that's just coming out now that says that if we use this as an order parameter, the typical one, then you can actually find, and self-consistently determined, you can find a transition at a finite value disorder where basically the spectrum goes from are continuous to the state.
What's the green line then?
The green line is the average density of states, which remains finite, and the typical density of states, so this is algebraic average and the geometric average. Okay. It's well known that the algebraic average remains finite simply because you have delta function peaks, but they're randomly positioned, and the algebraic average will just give a distribution of those peaks. But the typical density state is zero. So you see, this is interesting because a local distribution function, you can think of Anderson transition, local distribution function going from regular to a singular distribution where the most probable value and all the weight goes to zero. This, of course, all has been explained in the original, the first paper, okay, which has been forgotten by now. So now, let me tell you what, if we combine these ideas from DMFT with interactions and this kind of ideas from how to treat localization, and what is the basic phase diagram that we can get. So here's the phase diagram. This is a Fermi energy on the vertical axis, and the disorder both in terms of the on-site repulsion U. So this is for the Hubbard model with disorder. And at zero disorder, we have a transition from a metal to the not insulator as we lower the kinetic energy. But as we increase the disorder, we can actually close the Mott gap when the disorder is comparable to the basically to the interaction on-site repulsion. And then we have a Mott Anderson insulator, which is gapless. So the first question you can ask, if we decide to map the Sphygmont crystal melting to the to the Hubbard model, where will be the trajectory as we physically lower the density? And it's easy to answer because the kinetic energy in 2D scales is density. The correlation energy has the square root of the density, and this other is probably constant. So you'll find that the trajectory that you follow has the following form. It is a hyperbola. You start here, and then you're drifting over. So you may be able to skim near the actual ideal mode transition. If you start in a very clean sample, you'll be going through the region which is very strongly correlated. It has a large effective mass here. And then you'll hit the Mott transition probably. If you have a crummier sample, then you won't get here, and you expect that there will be a weaker temperature dependence and weaker signatures associated with strong correlation. And this seems to be the case. Crummier samples generally have smaller drop of resistivity, and there's all the signatures are somewhat weaker. So now I would like to tell you, show you some few examples of results that we can get from actually solving these DMFT equations for this kind of proposed Hubbard model. And the first question that I'd like to discuss is, what happens on the metallic side? So again, this is our phase diagram with the Mott insulator, Anderson Mott insulator, glass, and the metal. And I don't even want to get very close to the insulator. Let me stand somewhere, you know, march along this line. This line corresponds to physically reducing the kinetic energy. Just reducing the kinetic energy. Here's the kinetic energy in the vertical axis, the Fermi energy. So I'm reducing the Fermi energy, and I would like to know how is the temperature dependence going to change of my scattering rate due to the difference. And there, even early work has in this metallic range where probably localization is not already very too important yet. There has been a number of people, including Schuler, Maslow, Gasarma, Huang, Dolgopolov, and Gold, and Herbert, and Leiner, and others who have pointed out that if you just have a simple metal, if you do Hartree-Fock theory, well, then you'll be screening the randomness. This is a very general phenomenon. It's true for long-range interactions, it's true for short-range interactions, and almost any model will give you the fact that if you have repulsion, then you'll be screening, the randomness will be reduced at low temperatures, and as you go to high temperatures, the screening will be suppressed, and you will find something like original randomness. And so they said that they suggested all these people that the temperature dependence of the resistivity comes from the screening. And if we indeed solve our DMFT equations in the Hartree-Fock theory, that essentially all these people are doing, you know, you can think of when you're screening a single charge impurity, RPA will essentially can be obtained from this kind of Hartree-Fock picture, as everyone knows. So if we solve our DMFT equations in Hartree-Fock, we can basically reproduce qualitatively and even quantitatively all the results of these people. You'll find a drop of the resistivity, but there is a serious problem. The problem is that the first temperature dependence that you can get, and this has been in fact pointed out by these people, you can get maybe two over the resistivity will drop by a factor of two, but not very, very much with reasonable parameters. Okay, and plus the temperature, characteristic temperature scale here or energy scale is just the Fermi energy. So you know, you'll find some very weak temperature dependence, and basically you have to go above the Fermi temperature to unscrew. This is not what is seen in the experiment, where we find, in fact, rapid drop of resistivity and close to the transition in a rather restricted temperature range. So there is the point is that this theory has no small energy scale. Okay. In the experiment, we clearly see an emerging small energy scale. So there is, this is one problem, even though there's some kind of hint that kind of screening plays a role, it has been obtained from this theory. However, there is a very interesting and an amusing puzzle that you can ask yourself. You see, when you do RP or Hartree-Fock theory, everyone has learned in school that the amount of screening charge that you can obtain depends on nothing other than the compressibility of the system. Right? So if you're talking about screening of charged impurities or any impurities, then you would expect that the screening will be okay, the system is compressible, but as we are approaching a correlated state, we expect this compressibility to be strongly reduced because we are approaching an incompressible state. Okay? And in fact, calculations show that, for example, in DMFT, that the compressibility, we are talking about approaching this at half filling, which is the appropriate route for this problem. As you approach the transition by changing the bandwidth at half filling, then the compressibility will vanish. So you would, if you adopt the standard point of view relating the screening to compressibility, you would expect this mechanism that has been proposed to be of little significance precisely in the region where the effective mass is largely enhanced, which is close to the model position. Okay. But this is precisely where you find the drop of resistivity, not very far, but precisely in the same region where they find experimentally large mass enhancements. So there, this is a question mark. How can this be a reasonable picture?
Question.
Yes.
In the picture that you drew where you're looking at excitations in the Wigner crystal,
yes,
then it sort of makes sense. I can understand what you mean by half filling and why you are there. But in the metallic phase, they're not sites. So it's not clear what you mean by half filling.
That's right. That's right.
Of course, the results that you get is the instabilities of a Hubbard-like model. Of course, they depend very strongly on the band.
Absolutely.
But if you take a metallic Hubbard model and start increasing U, I mean, where the instabilities are and what the nature of the mix is depends a lot on the band filling. So I'm not sure.
Absolutely.
And
you're absolutely right. This is the reason why this it took a while to figure this out. It is because if you ask a person on the street what's the feeling in this problem, they'll say, well, it's very small because they have a very broad band and we are near the bottom of the band, so there is like almost empty band. How can this has anything to do with the half-field systems, right? It's because these bands you hybridized, and deep in the insulator, as you yourself point out, we have a half-field system. Now, how much of this survives on the metallic side? That's the big question mark. And the same, as Anton pointed out, the same question applies also to helium-3. The answer, with the plausible answer is the following, is that on short scales, there is a very strong short-range order. Okay?
There's a different kind of, there's experiments on helium-3, and it's a first-order transition.
That's right. That's right. And probably, almost certainly, Wigner crystallization is also weakly first-order transition. What we try to suggest is that once we have this order, then it will become second order transition A plus B. You can imagine that this lattice, which is a snapshot in time due to short range order, will be actually stabilized by impurities. And so, in reality, when you have a random system, this is a better picture than the clean one, where probably you will not be able to see a large mass enhancement from the metallic side. You're absolutely right. It's a first order transition. Once we are far enough from the Wigner crystal and if there's a jump, everything is double different.
I'm really confused when you talk about helium-3. Do you mean three-dimensional or two-dimensional helium-3?
Most experiments are done with three-dimensional helium-3. I mean, this is just was the original motivation from the Green-Rice theory was helium-3 from liquid to solid transition, and this is well known.
There are also
the liquid could have local crystalline-like order on short time scales.
Yes.
You know, this is the original Anderson Brinkmann idea, and
yes.
Whether it's true or not.
It's a question of different time scales. There's a process for pairwise exchange that tends to close the mod gap. What is the time scale for that process? Basically, the excitation across virtual excitations across that gap as compared to the time scale for moving these big chunks. Yeah. Probably this time scale for moving chunks is much larger, and with disorder it's maybe even, you know, ridiculously large. And so when you compare these two time scales, then you may argue that on the relevant time scale, is you essentially have a lattice. Of course, as Anton points out, this is not a new issue here. In helium-3, it may be a little bit better defined because they have a hard core. Here, we don't have a hard core, so it's a bigger question mark here. But this physical idea is the same. Okay, so now let me turn to what you get from DMFT. I want to show you this is sort of like, it came to a big surprise to me. We discovered two different things. Is that even though this argument says, conventional screening theory says that compressibility going to zero will eliminate screening, if you actually calculate screening within, for example, a Gutzwiller wave function approximation, you will find that it doesn't go away because it's the formula that relates screening to compressibility is obtained within a Hartree approximation. This is an incorrect approximation, and you can just show that there are higher order terms which bring some Gondel-like processes into the game which totally dominate the Hartree term. And the screening, even though the compressibility goes to zero, at zero temperature, becomes strongly enhanced in the vicinity of the mode transition. So you get, at low temperatures, much lower resistivity than you would expect based on standard screening here. Of course, you should remember that, you know, how we skim the trajectory in the physical sense, this is a little bit subtle question, because we are at the same time reducing the bandwidth and increasing disorder. So the density dependence of this intercept is a non-trivial question that needs to be addressed by more detailed calculations. But I'm saying that screening will not go away. On the other hand, there is something very important missing also from the Hartree point of view. In Hartree fog theory, you're talking about a static random potential being temperature dependent. At each temperature, there is another static random potential. But this has no inelastic scattering. We know, everyone knows in this room, that once we are in the regime of strong correlation, and we go at the temperatures which are above some coherence temperature, then there's a huge inelastic scattering. This inelastic scattering turns out actually totally dominates the high temperature behavior. And we are not talking about low temperatures here. We are talking about temperatures which are a third of the Fermi energy. That's the relevant temperature range. Okay? Plus, there is another important issue here, is that instead of a single coherence temperature, when you have a random system, some regions will have higher and some regions lower coherence temperatures. There's a broader distribution. And so you more gradually find the coherence. You know that near the mode transition resistivity shoots way up and then it turns around. It looks nothing like the experiments. This calculation is done when the correlation U is equal to W in this order, and we change the bandwidth. And as you can, these are several different values of the bandwidth. But you can see these curves look very much like the experimental one. Here's the experimental curve, and here's the theoretical curve. Yes.
If I were to extract the mean breakout in a very naive manner from the absolute value of the resistivity measured in experiment.
At low temperatures.
No, in the incoherent regime.
Yes.
What would you get?
Well, I think, you know, in the experiments, if you are, these curves, they all merge at high temperature to a value where the mean free path is the only one. Or as KFL is the only one. So, actually, we have, you know, in this calculation, it's really neat. In DMFT, you can separate the elastic and the instelastic. You can take the self-energy, the real part, or the imaginary part. You can compare them and see where the scattering comes from. And you can see that most of this scattering comes totally inelastic. And you see, you can easily get a factor of 10. You can get anything you want, in fact, here, basically. But you may not be too close, in reality, to this, you know, incipient mode transition in practice. So the point is that, you know, there are two scales here. One is the renormalized temperature scale, which is renormalized basically by the effective mass enhancement, which can be large. So we can push the phenomenon to low enough energies, as opposed to Hartree fog. And there's also a vertical scale, which depends on the disorder. So I was actually amazed how similar this leads to experiment. In Hartree fog theory, you get a linear curve. And you'll see in the experiments that it's not linear anywhere. It's not linear here, and it's not linear here. There's a saturation. So it just doesn't seem to work. And, you know, if we do, this is an example of a calculation in large dimensions, we can control this, because the Hartree fog theory, that really depends very weakly on the soil. And we can, in a controlled way, just quantitatively ask a question when we put correlations in the relevant range where the correlation is comparable to disorder, you know, what do we get? And we can show that the incoherent processes are extremely important and in fact dominate, totally dominate transport. So this is why, you know, this is not the Hartree-Fockley not necessarily a good approach. And I would like to emphasize to people who are familiar with the so-called Finkelstein theory that the leading log that you get in the interaction corrections of Schuller, Rahn, or Finkelstein, they come out of the Hartree-Fockley level already. The physical meaning, this has been emphasized by a liner a couple of years ago. The physical meaning of these logs is that you have a random potential that's screened and is temperature dependent, but the temperature dependence is different in the ballistic and in the diffusive regime, but it's still a static random potential. In the diffusive regime, it adopts you get a log for. But this comes only from the temperature dependence of the static part. The point I'm making here, you know, is that you have a much bigger effect coming from inelastic processes, and these are totally left out in this decoupling approach. And this is a serious problem in our view. So, now I'd like to say a few words about what happens when you put disorder, you know, we go to stronger disorder, and the emerging picture that we have obtained from combining these standard DMFT with loss localization approach that I described is that as you approach the Smott-Anderson transition, which is now a gapless state, the transport, you get a second order transition, and this is actually a picture obtained only for the non-interacting problem, but you get similar results also with interactions, that your conductivity can change from metallic gradually to insulating, and just you change the slope gradually, and there is a separatrix. So conductivity continuously goes to zero with some exponent. So this is very similar as in a Anderson-like transition. However, the electrons are characterized with their quasi-particle weight. The quasi-particle weight is inversely proportional to the effective mass in the MFT and goes to zero at the transition. Here we have a random problem, and we need to keep track of the distribution of these quasi-particle weights, which may be position-dependent. But you can define a typical value, which is again given by the geometric average, and you can show here is the result of actually numerical calculation that we've done. Typical quasi-particle weight going to zero at the same transition where the conductivity vanishes. This simply means that a certain fraction of spins, certain fraction of sites turn into local moments where the electron turns into a spin. So basically, my main message here is that even this transition, in terms of compressibility, in terms of transport, looks very different from the clean Mott transition. Some features of the Mott transition, in particular, the fact that there is a renormalized energy scale that vanishes at the transition, which is associated with basically local mass enhancement, this survives, and essentially you get a very large susceptibility enhancement, specific heat enhancement near the transition. This is an interesting thing because if you look actually in the 2 plus epsilon theories, in all universality classes that are controlled, you'll find actually the specific heat actually goes to zero and not to infinity, which seems like a very bizarre thing because you'd expect whenever the quasi-particle weight goes to zero, whenever the quasi-particle dies, okay, you should get a specific heat enhancement. In these theories that are controlled in 2 plus epsilon, for example, spinless electron case, you don't find any specific heat enhancement. And that tells you basically that this physical meaning of these theories that I have renormalized single particle states that get localized, but you really don't have a quasi-particle dying. This theory has describes the death of the quasi-particle.
I'm not sure I understand how you define quasi-particle weight in a disorderly system.
Okay, good question. This is, in this DMFT theory, you can define self-energy on a given site, and this self-energy is local, purely local. Now, in the non-uniform case, the self-energy will become a function of site. Okay, it will be different on different sites. And then if you look at the linear, the coefficient of the linear part in frequency of that self-energy, this will define your effective mass normalization. Okay, in the clean case. And so this will, if you generalize this to the disorder case, they will give you local disease.
But why is that a good definition? I don't understand.
It simply relates to
in general some diagonal thing.
Right.
Basically,
you can show in this particular model that this describes this. It tells you how large is the specific heat it has.
Yeah, but it's probably better to answer in a more general way. I mean, you can look at the one particle Green's function of the disorder system in an exact eigenstate representation if you want, and you have the non-interacting system. And so you have some Green's function, then you turn on the interactions, and then you add a matrix self-energy. Okay, and in principle, you can define a lambda Fermi liquid theory for that. Now, what happens in dynamic mean field theory is that that self-energy matrix happens to be diagonal inside indices because you assume that it's local, and we're able to compute the statistics.
Partly, the Fermi liquid theory has been generalized to disordered systems, and there is, you can define more generally these quantities. This is a specific realization of this, but in fact, this has been done in the 80s based on Finkelstein's theory, actually. So I mean, the point is, but the point is that there is, you know, you can imagine here is a region where basically I give me more specific heat, and you can say this is a region which has smaller quantum particle weight. Or, you know, in Orlando-Ginzburg sense, you can say, you know, if I put an external potential which is very smooth, right, and then the effective mass will also be smooth, you know, by the linear.
I mean, the key point in Fermi liquid theory is that you can make correspondence between the spectrum of some non-interacting Hamiltonian and the interacting Hamiltonian. You can also do that in a random situation on where you don't have translation invariance.
That's general.
I can imagine you can do it in some perturbative.
Yes,
sense, but
absolutely.
Well, Fermi liquid theory,
I agree.
Is non-perturbative.
I agree. All this is perturbative, and the concepts were sort of developed starting from the weak disorder end, where one can do perturbation theory in both disorder and interactions. Now, here there's one further approximation which allows the computations, however, and we extend them.
That is a local theory. That is a local theory.
Well,
I don't know. I mean, on quite general ground, if I was looking at the local interacting density of states, right?
Yeah.
If this would be peak, then it could have a certain
right.
width.
No, I mean,
the
that's
I
right.
can make a histogram of this width. This could
well,
be
yeah.
peak.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there is a relatively right. simple right. and reasonable definition of this.
You
may not
want to call it quasi-particle.
Yeah, I don't know why I should call it quasi-particle.
Because
maybe
in the weak,
it's another parameter.
Because in the weak disorder perturbative region, it is the quasi-particle.
Not only for weak disorder. For any system, even an atom, you can imagine that as you turn on the interaction, you know that you can start from states and then they evolve, right? Now, these states that you evolve by turning on interaction, as they evolve from the interacting states on, okay, they will evolve differently in different regions. The wave functions will evolve differently, right? And the corresponding overlap will depend on where you are. So I think that's just, anyway. So what I would like to say here is that this feature that we have a small energy scale and corresponding to a small Zeeman scaling problem is something that's very, very robust, even if we get rid of the Mott gap. But the Mott-Anderson transition preserves enough Mott character that this is a very robust feature and actually comes out of here. So I wanted to say that, you see, even in this simple couple of results that I've shown you, the large Doppler resistivity, the emergence of a small energy scale, some of these puzzling features are immediately defined very simple, in fact, transparent physical interpretation. And the final part of this talk, I have another 10 or 15 minutes, I would like to say something what happens closer to the insulator or on the insulating side in terms of the question how many ground states do we have, what kind of order states that is. And this is an old question, and it has been addressed by Efer Shklovsky and many other people, and the idea is that as you go from the fluid to the insulator, then in the insulator the electrons, the repulsion would like to keep the electrons apart, the random potential to keep them non-uniform, and there is a large amount of frustration. So there are many, many metastable states, and this has been confirmed in classical models, which are okay very deep in the insulator by many simulations. Okay, so this is well known that there are a very large number of states, but what was not known is as you approach from the metallic side and you go towards the insulator, how soon is this going to pop out, and how does it affect, or how does it show up in your experiments? So this is the idea, basically, from a fluid to this glass, the main difference is not in some static order parameter, but it's just a number of these metastable states, and this is most clearly seen in dynamics. Now, I would like to show you now data. Okay, these are data by Dragan Popovic in our laboratory that has measured the dynamics of transport in the sense that you measure the conductance as a function of time, and you record traces as a function of time. So this is high density, you see rather small noise. At low density, below some well-defined density, there is a huge noise. This is order one. that evolves. And now, you know, you would like to be more specific. You would like to analyze this noise. And this can be done very carefully because the amount of data you can record is huge. And so you can do very careful spectroscopy of this noise. You can look at the Fourier spectrum of the noise. You can also do measure high-order correlation functions to determine whether the noise is an uncorrelated noise or it's a correlated noise, and how all these features depend on density. So here is the time average conductivity for this particular sample. This was a very fairly dirty sample. And at the high temperatures, you have something like a metallic behavior, even though the metallic behavior is very weak. There is a density where it's totally flat. This is your separatrix. There is a density where the activation energies in the insulating side vanish, which is much lower here. And then there is an intermediate region which seems to be like a poor metal. But when they analyze noise, and I'll describe this in a few seconds in a bit more detail, when you analyze noise, you'll see that the noise changes its spectral characters dramatically at an intermediate density N plus here. Okay, there are many details of this analysis which I will not describe, but the only thing I would like to describe is the analysis of correlations in the noise. Noise generally, this is generally 1 over F type noise, with the F exponent on the F changing with density, but you can generally get 1 over F noise. Many people's models were just independent two-level centers which have distribution frequency scales. So if you have independent centers like this, you can easily get 1 over F noise. What is little more specific is whether this noise can be represented as a superposition of independent contributions from many fluctuators with different frequencies, and it doesn't matter what kind of fluctuator you have. Okay, the first spectrum, the Fourier spectrum, will not tell you whether they are correlated or not, but you can measure a certain fourth-order statistics, fourth-order correlation function, to determine the non-Gaussian character of the noise. This is called the so-called second spectrum analysis, and has been first emphasized and proposed in studying metallic spin glasses by Mike Weissman and Noyce 10 years ago. Played a very important role in pure spin glasses. And you can do the same analysis, and you can determine the so-called second spectrum as a function of the second frequency. The important thing to remember here is that if you have uncorrelated fluctuators, then the second spectrum should be frequency independent, and if they are strongly correlated, then you get strong frequency independence. And this is at high density. In low density, you can fit it to power law form, and then you can fit that power that describes the power law form of the second spectrum as a function of density. Here, for these two very different samples, this is a low disorder sample. This is the same one that Kravchenko has, and you can see within error bars there are no correlations up to this density, and then there is a very strong correlation emerging, exactly at the same density where the separatrix is found. In this low mobility or highly disordered samples, again, you have no correlations. They emerge at some density before the apparent metal insulator transition. And so there seems to be an intermediate metallic glass phase that is well defined. So whether the glass transition coincides with the metal insulator transition or not depends on whether you have high disorder or low disorder. But very generally, we find strong non-Gaussian noise or strong correlations in the insulating side. I would like to say just a few words in terms of I would like to say a few words now in some theoretical work that we have done in recent couple of years to understand this behavior. And this can be done by putting some inter-site interactions which will like to frustrate the distribution of the charge densities. And so then this is a standard model that Efron Skotsky have been done. The difference is that we haven't used the realistic Kolmogorov interaction, but a simpler form of the interaction. But at this mean field level that I'm going to adopt, this appears to make very little difference. The issue here is that you would like to, using standard Parisi-like scheme of replica integrator, we can address the question whether we have a single minimum of the free energy, single thermodynamic state, or many emerging. And the criterion for stability of a non-glassy state, so this equation tells you when the glass transition is going to emerge in the sense of many metastable states developed. And in this charge sector, this involves non-local compressibilities here. you can think of this 1 minus this correlation function as a Landau, in the Landau-Hilbert theory, as a coefficient of a quadratic term, which will trigger the instability. What is interesting is that we found that this correlation function actually diverges at the Anderson transition, Anderson-like transition, and it actually goes to zero at the Mach transition where the compressibility goes to zero. So this is very sensitive to what kind of transition you have. What it says, when this grows, becomes very large close to the Anderson transition, and you only have to make it 1, you don't have to make it infinite. So because this grows at the Anderson transition, it diverges, then you immediately conclude that at this meaningful level, you cannot coincide the 2 transitions, that the glass transition has to necessarily come before the metal and sweater one. And this is exactly what it seems that Dragana has been able to observe in very dirty samples. If we go to lower density, then presumably you're approaching the incipient Mott transition where the compressibility is suppressed. This is going to become small, and we will not be able to get the glass until we really get closer to the insulin. And this is the phase diagram that emerges. This is going to come out probably in a few weeks in press, the paper that has this phase diagram. This is the phase diagram that we obtain from these arguments. We have a Mott insulator, a Mott Anderson gapless insulator, a metal, and then here's the metallic glass that actually comes before the Mott-Anderson insulator, but must shrink as we are approaching opening the Mott gap. And similar behavior, consistently, this has been seen, in fact, also in indium oxide films by a group from Hebrew University in Israel, Tzvi Eliyahu. So it seems a very reasonable picture that the many rearrangements that you associated with glossy behavior have to be suppressed once you go to the incompressible state. This is quite a reasonable picture. And as you reduce the disorder, you expect this kind of glassiness to be suppressed. And so this seems to vary consistently with experiments. If we start with a dirty sample, we can go through this glassy phase. If we start with a very clean sample, we may not be able to see it. There are other many interesting questions that in this metallic glass phase, there may be some non-trivial dynamics associated with the fact that in the glass, there are many low-lying rearrangements. This is in the parallels of this Parisi-like theory. It's called the replicon mode. But it just corresponds to many low-lying rearrangements of the charge density. And if you do a simple calculation, the meaningful level, we find that there's a non-Fermi liquid temperature dependence here that has been first, in fact, pointed out in the context of metallic spin glasses, I think, by Antoine and also Subir Sajdev and others. But you get the same temperature.
You mean rho, not sigma.
Well, you know, this is a difference from zero temperature.
Oh, okay, sorry.
But it doesn't matter. This is a leading one. So actually, Dragana was able to observe it due to the 3/2 temperature dependence here. This is actually truly remarkable because actually, you know, she came out and she says, where does the 3/2 come from? And I said, well, it comes from our theory. So we were very happy with that. So basically, I think I can stop here. Let me just conclude briefly. I tried to convince you that there is a simple physical picture, that Wigner crystal melting in presence of disorder, we can think of it as a Mott-Anderson transition, that you can start using standard methods. We have developed some features of the NFT methods to incorporate in quantum physics, which is the Anderson localization as well as glossy behavior. However, these are methods where you can do qualitative and quantitative calculations. And somewhat surprisingly is that we find that actually relatively encouraging agreement with many experimental features in the metallic phase as you approach the transition, and also on the insulating side where we find similar glossy features to what the experiment seem to observe. So with this, I'll stop, and thank you very much.
Questions?
If you describe this typical medium theory in which you just talking about just the non-interacting case, in which you take delta to be t squared exponential of the average of log rho, what kind of critical behavior does that give for the transition?
It gives linear critical behavior. That advantage is linear. Of course, you know, this is a meaningful theory. You know that this is strongly dimensionality dependent.
Sure.
And this is actually, you know, there is a very somehow unfortunate feature of the Anderson transition that the upper Hilbert dimension is apparently infinite. So we can't hope that this meaningful theory actually works in any dimension, at any dimension, not even in infinity, because it's not exact even on the Bethe lattice. However, you know, you may think of it as something that probably describes short scales and has a character of a Floyd-like theory, for example, not really being it's not another parameter theory in the same sense that Landau-Ginzburg is. You can control it with some epsilon expansion, but unless you are looking at long scales, it may not make much difference. In fact, you know, we have actually compared the predictions. We can do, you know, for given lattice structure and model of disorder, you can solve these equations and compare them. We have compared them with exact diagonalization studies. Unless you are very close to transition, we have found actually excellent agreement. So we have gone through great lengths with my collaborator, Danislav Nikolic, who is an expert on exact diagonalization of disorder system. We have really done huge. We've done 16 by 16 by 16 cubes. So you know, you can get excellent statistics to compare with the I think we have some evidence that this works reasonably well, unless you're extremely close.
Can you scale the whole distribution of conductance close to the critical?
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what actually we have to do in the numerical calculation. We have to do finite size standard. You can do standard finite size scaling. And actually, I can show you. We have a preprint coming out where the paper will be coming out where I have the scaling plots with the collapse and the scaling function.
Okay. Other questions?
If not, let's thank Vlad again. I remember at 2:00 we have the talk by Katie Fries on cosmology for condensed matter physicists in the founders room.